Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt, and we're brought to you by the California 1020, coming up on Sunday, February 15th. That's 10 miles, 20 bands, Del Mar Fairgrounds, Stensenitas, and back. Great post-race concert featuring Don Felder from the Eagles. That's cal1020.com. Try-palooza.com. Our endurance awards coming up Saturday, February 21st. Expo Clinics Awards. Meb Kefleski, Dean Karnazes, Molly Huddle, Meredith Kessler, some of the biggest names. We're also brought to you by Core Sports, the very best in women's athletic wear and function smart physical therapy. Our next guest, the author of the book Embrace the Suck, Mr. Steve Madden. Steve, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm wonderful. So take me back, Steve. What were your sports growing up?
Well, it's kind of funny. I get into this in the book. When I was when I was a little kid, I was sort of the fat kid in the neighborhood and couldn't keep up with my friends. And my mom, who I describe in the book as a badass, just came home and announced one day that she had signed me up for hockey. I grew up in Boston, and everybody played hockey.
Right.
She said, "You're going to do it." And I was terrified. And she brought me down to this rink in Squanum, Mass. I don't know if it's even still there. It was an old airplane hangar. And put me out on the ice with all these other kids who were skating circles around me. But I loved it. I was no good at it, but I had a lot of fun doing it. And, you know, after having been a fat kid, what I found about, or having still been a fat kid, what I found out was that there was a lot to be said for momentum on ice, and all of a sudden I wasn't as slow as I was when I was trying to run. So one thing led to another, and I ended up playing quite a lot of hockey, and then had sort of a breakthrough moment with running when I was in junior high. And so when I was in high school, I was a track athlete. I played soccer, and I started getting into bike racing when I was 16. And so those are the three things that carried me through all the way through college.
So when you're talking cycling and running, the next step normally would be triathlon. What the heck?
Well, funny you should say that. I did my first triathlon when I was between my senior year of high school and freshman year of college, and absolutely loved it, except I was, I wouldn't say I was a bad swimmer, but that's where I lost all the ground. I came in second in my age group in that race, and it was just because the kid who won it, I still remember his name, Tony Pat, he just spanked me on the swim. And so when I went to college, I decided that I was going to learn how to swim, and took a swim training course and kind of learned how to do it, and then actually developed into, if I do say so myself, a decent, like, local master's swimmer in my 20s and 30s. And it did more triathlons, but gravitated more toward either the swimming or the running. Or the cycling. Running seemed to have lost its charm for me as I got older, because when I was in high school, I was a 400 guy, and anything over a minute killed me.
So, and when did you move into, you know, working for Bicycling Magazine and obviously investing most of your time in two wheels?
I was the editor of Bicycling Magazine from 2002 to 2008.
This day remains
the best job I've ever had.
You know, it's funny, 2002 to 2008, we're talking, you know, Lance 101, right? It's basically
the entire
era. So how tough was that era? Because I went through it as well, when people were like, you know, yeah, this guy's winning, but we all think your sport is dirty. And there was enough people going dirty that it felt like cycling took the brunt for every other sport out there that really didn't do any testing.
It did. I mean, I sort of used to... It was difficult, you know. I was in a difficult spot because, you know, being the editor in chief of that magazine at that time, it was hard for me to say publicly. The burden of proof was two positive tests, right?
Right, right.
And we just didn't have it, and there was a lot of suspicion, if not just outright knowledge. But you couldn't go forward with that because anything. You know, Armstrong was super litigious and
powerful
and unbelievably powerful.
Right.
Was, you know, he, a word from Lance, it could just snuff all kinds of contracts and stuff from us. And so we, we never pursued the story. I wish, you know, I look back now, I wish that I had had more guts and pursued it, but I'm not sure how it would have ended, actually.
I'm betting court.
No, it wouldn't even have got to court. I mean, he was so litigious and so powerful that I'm sure, you know, we would have retracted it. We would have said, look, the Times of London,
yes,
got into it with him, and it didn't end well for them.
No, they lost.
So I don't think it was going to end all that well for Vertical Enthusiast magazine.
You know, what's interesting to me is it used to be that athletes sort of needed the media for, you know, to get notoriety, to talk about their causes, whatever it happened to be. And I think Lance was really one of the first ones in our world. All of a sudden, when you're talking, 2-3 million Twitter followers, you've got your own forum. You don't need the media. You are the media.
Yeah, exactly. Remember, this was all 2002. Seems like the dark ages now. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. He could just, his guys told us one time, we were like, look, why are you shutting us down? Because he wouldn't talk to us.
Right.
Just wouldn't talk to us, wouldn't acknowledge us. And his agent said, we don't need you guys. You know, we need the women's magazines. We're bigger than bicycling. We're, you know, literally it's not about the bike. We want to be with Men's Journal and GQ and Esquire. And and so that's what they pursued, and we were left to pick up crumbs. So
And he moved the needle. That was the hard part from a media perspective. We knew putting him on the cover of the magazine or having an article inside the magazine meant you're going to get more pickup.
Yeah, but it wasn't a huge pickup. You know, if it were a huge pickup, I would have had him on the cover of every issue.
Right.
But it was, you know, it was noticeable, but it wasn't like a box office. It wasn't like guaranteed box office to have him there. But, you know, he did all that. He transcended cycling.
Right.
I mean, he was Michael Jordan.
Right.
You know, Michael Jordan didn't need to talk to the media. It was part of the Jordan rules, right? Like, he just didn't need to do it. And Lance could just, you know, do it by himself. And yet, for a guy who didn't want to deal with the media, was unbelievably thin-skinned about what
everything
everybody said. And he read everything.
Yes. Oh, I know. I get calls when I did an interview with Greg LeMond in 06 for the show. And seriously, it wasn't 5 hours after it went online that I'm getting called from the guy. So, you know, that was the hard part. If you wanted access to Lance, you sort of had to be part of the team.
Right. And he had made the decision that because of questions that we asked, that we weren't part of the team. And so we just completely got the schneid.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's always tough. So when you left bicycling, and talk a little bit about how your training changed over time, because your new book, Embrace the Suck, is about, you know, it's about CrossFit. It's about totally different workouts than really any of us have done before. What made you decide to immerse yourself in that world? Because it's a totally different world.
Well, I had sort of a conversion experience one night during Christmas vacation. I was lying on the couch and was enjoying a bottle of wine and wanted to get up and get another glass. And I had just looking back earlier that week. This was probably like in 2007 or so. And figured out that I had ridden 4,000 miles, which was a pretty good year for me.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get off. I couldn't, like, do a sit-up to get off the couch to go get another glass of wine. I had to, like, push myself up with my arms.
Yeah.
So my wife had just read something in the New York Times about this new training regimen called CrossFit. And the Times really sensationalized it. They talked about, you know, like, people making themselves so ill on these workouts that they had to go to the hospital and stuff. And I figured that a lot of that stuff was BS, but that the results that these guys were talking about seemed undeniable. So we started getting into it. We did a lot of this stuff in our driveway in our garage, because it was, at this point, was in December and the riding wasn't too good.
Right.
And I was still doing, you know, trainer riding. You know, we live in the Northeast, so there's a lot of training riding that goes on this time of year. But this adjunct was really nice, and I noticed a real pop in March when we got back out on the road, and so I started doing more and more of it. Now, one of the great benefits of working at Bicycling Magazine in the office in Emmaus, Pennsylvania, is the culture of the daily lunchtime ride.
Exactly.
when I left bicycling, I was still working for Rodale, but I was based in the New York office, so there was no more lunchtime ride, and I needed something that I could do to maintain my sanity and my fitness. And I started doing CrossFit, started going to a CrossFit gym, which had just opened near our house in New Jersey. And I just get pulled in, pulled in from there.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you are a cyclist and you're going, you're riding 3-4 hours at a time, and you think you're uber fit. And sometimes you get a little wake-up call and realize that, yeah, I'm cycling fit, but I'm not necessarily fit.
Right. Well, you get, no matter, if you do only one thing all the time, you get very fit for that.
Right.
I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. My wife and I went to a TRX class this morning.
Yeah.
This morning, our very first one. And we were both like, holy cow, this is a lot harder than we thought it was going to be. And this is, on top of doing CrossFit 3 or 4 days a week, and swimming and riding and everything else. So any sort of routine where you do the same thing all the time gets you in shape for exactly that. The thing I like about CrossFit is it comes as close to anything that I've come across, in keeping me, I can train that way and then get in the water and still do a decent swim, get on the bike and still do a decent ride. I'm not going to get in and rip anybody's legs off on a ride, but, I can hang, and that's what I'm looking for.
It's interesting because people think of our athletes, cyclists or triathletes, as really the fittest athletes around. And I remember, at some of the bike races I went to, these guys look like old men. Like getting off the bike and trying to walk, and you're going, oh my God, because like you said, they're specifically fit for that.
Well, I'm gonna instantly show how old I am by saying that I can remember when I was in high school and starting to read about triathlon that the guy who was sort of the dominant force at the time was John Howard, who had been an Olympic cyclist.
Right.
Howard talked about how he came to cross training because he was at the 76 Olympics in Montreal, and he was on his bike, and he comes into the Olympic Village after a training ride, and they tell him he's got to get off his bike, and it starts to rain, and he's got to run with his bike. He's probably in an old pair of Detto Pietro shoes, but he's got to run like 200 yards with the bike on his shoulder, and he said the next day he couldn't walk. Because of that run, and he figures, well, it's time to start doing other stuff.
That's funny.
So you do any one thing, you get really good at that, but you try and mix it up, and it could lead to some problems.
When I look at CrossFit over the years, there's all, besides the fact it's obviously gets you in great shape, right? And the whole idea of mixing things up, surprising your muscles, et cetera, is great. But one of the things that people have talked about is the injury side of it. Here you got some 50-year-old guy, he's fatigued, and he's got a kettlebell, and he's sort of yanking this thing. The form part of this is so essential because you're so fatigued, I think there is an obvious chance that people get injured.
Yeah, for sure. And that's where the coaching comes in. One of the key elements of going to a CrossFit workout at a box, like an affiliate, is
right,
that you're going to get coaching. And you need to make sure, you do need to have some responsibility to look out for yourself. You need to make sure that it's good coaching. I coach, and I tell people all the time, I coach a lot of people in their 40s and 50s, that like I don't care how much weight you can lift. I'd rather that you do this with a plane bar or even a PVC pipe and do it right, and then start worrying about adding the weight. Because trying to do an Olympic lift with a heavy load when you become fatigued is just a recipe for disaster unless you have really, really, really great form. And as we all know, any kind of form, swimming, cycling, anything, it suffers when you get tired.
Yeah.
So you have to be super careful about that and super careful about the load you put on and super careful about how, be really assiduous about your form.
So it's one thing to say you need to be cautious about your form, but when you add the competitive element, how many rounds can I do? You know how guys are, especially. It's all about I want to win.
I wouldn't necessarily ascribe that just to guys. I'm a regular at
that's
an
good point.
At an 8:30 a.m. workout with a bunch of women who are total fire breathers and who are always conscious of how they're doing compared to everybody else.
Right.
And yeah, it's a really important thing. You need to check your ego at the door when you come in, because what we all want is to be able to come back and do it again the next day.
What we see over time, you know, like when spin classes started, everybody thought, well, this is just going to be a fad. And it hasn't been. I mean, people are still going to spinning all the time. And I think when CrossFit started, it was the same type of deal. People were like, okay, people can do this for a while. They're going to get injured or they're going to get burned out because it's all so high intensity and they're going to go away. What do you see in terms of CrossFit? Is it still booming?
Yeah, it's absolutely still booming. My wife and I were just on vacation. We went to the Cayman Islands, and on Grand Cayman, which is this island that has like 55,000 people, I think, there are at least two boxes, and they're about 400 yards apart.
Wow.
And we went to both of them, and both of them were packed. So it's growing, and I think that, you know, and here in New Jersey, the community couldn't support another CrossFit box. Another one opens and seems to be doing great business. So, yeah, it's definitely growing. But look, I mean, all of this stuff, it's the great thing about fitness. It's the great thing about what we do, right? Like, somebody comes up with something else, and it can boom for a while, and then it finds its place, you know? There was a time when some people would have you believe that Tai Bo was going to take over the world.
Right, yep.
And that didn't happen. And yet, you know, you want to go find a Tai Bo class, you can. You want to find a Zumba class, you know, you can.
Jazzercise, all that stuff's still out there. Everything's there.
I do think CrossFit's got legs, though, because of the results that it achieves and just the absolute zeal with which people come to it. You know, it's like, if somebody's really into CrossFit, you might not want to sit next to them on an airplane because they're just gonna, you know, pin you in your seat and talk about how it's changed their life. But that's like people are that way with anything that is a huge benefit to their lives. And I think I definitely see that with CrossFit. I know an awful lot of people who whose lives have been vastly improved by it, as it has by triathlon and cycling and swimming and everything else.
So how has it changed your life?
Given me a lot more confidence. It's one of the things I talk about in the book is how once a fat kid picked last for a team, always a fat kid, and you know you can always that's always sort of in the back of your head. You can I would come to any workout I've done, like, you know, I don't know how many times I've climbed Alpe d'Huez, and every time I do, I think I'm a fat kid. This climb's going to kill me. And yet there I am riding my bike up this thing, right? And CrossFit's helped me largely vanquish that voice from the back of my head. Because if you had told me, I'm 51, and if you had told me that when I was age 25 that I'd be throwing Olympic weights around the way I am, I wouldn't have believed you. And so that's a huge benefit. That's a great thing that carries over to other aspects of my life.
One of the workouts that I'd heard about with CrossFit was the Murph. Because we're out here in San Diego and SEALs and are obviously a big part of the community here. And Michael Murphy, I think it was that CrossFit workout, the Murph was named after him. For our audience, give them an idea what the Murph is.
So Murph is a workout when Michael, Lieutenant Michael Murphy was still alive, Murph, the workout Murph was called Body Armor. And what it consisted of is a one-mile run, 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 air squats, and then another mile run. And it was called Body Armor because Murph and some of his comrades used to do it with their body armor on. And a weight vest.
Yeah.
But a body armor vest weighs about 20 pounds. And so it's now, there are two versions of, and when he was killed in Afghanistan, unfortunately, the workout was named, renamed Murph. And it, you can do Murph heavy, which means you do it with body armor, or you can do Murph, which means you do it without body armor. And as a matter of fact, I work out at CrossFit Annex in Chatham, New Jersey, and we're doing half Murph on Sunday morning as a precursor to our Super Bowl parties, just as a way to, you know, we'll cut all the distances in half because it's too cold and icy here to run outside. So we'll run inside, but it's sort of the workout is almost one of the chapters in the book is about an event I did called the 20X Challenge,
yep.
which was run by a box near you guys in San Diego, and it's basically a 14-hour beatdown workout, or like three workouts, you know, and one of the workouts is Murph, and some of the guys who ran this were former SEALs who actually knew Murph, and it was pretty amazing to hear about this guy, like
yeah.
what a great guy he was, and the way he died, you know, he knew he was exposing himself to great risk.
Sure.
He knew he was helping his comrades. And so they approached the workout almost as a sacrament, and they're very serious about when you do this, you must do it, give it your all, and you can't quit, because Murph was that kind of guy.
Right. So why do they call, rather than calling it a gym, it's the box?
You know, I don't really know. It's a good
okay.
question. I think if I could hazard a guess, now, if I say this, I'm sure someone from CrossFit will
correct
me
you.
Correct me.
Yeah.
But I think it's because you could get a lot of the stuff. You know, you go to there are a couple of different suppliers of CrossFit equipment, Rogue probably being the largest one, and again, Faster. And you could call and order a bunch of this stuff, and it showed up in
yeah.
boxes.
Right.
Big box. I don't know. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's the fact that these places tended, especially early on, to be in like in big industrial spaces.
Yeah,
warehouses, industrial spaces,
yeah.
old auto dealerships, old gas stations, boxy looking places.
Got it. And the book is out now.
Mm-hmm.
What? How's it doing?
It's good. It's in a second printing.
Nice.
Which is always a good sign.
Yes.
But if you and everyone listening to this could tell 5,000 of their friends,
exactly,
that would be a big help. I got three kids I got to put through college.
So a lot of folks like to work out and not suffer. When a book is called "Embrace the Suck" and CrossFit is about suffering, is that a barrier to entry for people coming over?
I don't think so. Especially people with cycling backgrounds. I mean, success in cycling is predicated on your ability to endure suffering.
That's, right.
That's a direct quote from George Hincappie.
Yep.
So, you know, if you're coming from cycling and you know, like I'm just going to take it out there, I'm going to take it up right up to the red line, and I'm just going to leave it there, and you can take it up and leave it there for 3 hours
yeah.
and do it again the next day, then, you know, taking it up there and leaving it there for 4 minutes it might not be so bad. It's a completely different kind of hurt. It's like, you know, we were lifting. The weightlifting part to me was the real revelation. And to do that, to do these weightlifts, like heavy
yeah.
loads, it still kind of takes me. Sometimes I'm really curious about what's happening biochemically because I see the white light and I hear the angels sometimes. in a way I never did when I was cycling. But, you know, it takes some getting used to. But I think that if you can go out and just, you know, bludgeon yourself on a swim or a run or a ride, then, you know, doing it with this shouldn't be any problem.
Has CrossFit helped your cycling?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got much better leg strength. I've got much better lower back strength too, so it's easier for me to stay down. My shoulders are stronger. I feel like I have better midline stability, and I have better shoulder stability. And I also have a better top end, you know,
yeah.
such
high intensity.
To the extent that I have a top end, it's better.
So, as a cycling guy, who is the favorite cyclist that you covered?
You know, I loved Floyd Landis. I just thought his story was so great.
Yes.
I love Davis Finney.
Yes.
A special affinity for him now because my mom had Parkinson's disease, and Lamont, because when we were and when I was a kid, there was a guy named, you know, there was Jacques Boyer, right?
Right.
Jonathan Boyer,
yeah.
And but he was you know, it's like you said earlier, we didn't have the same kind of media in the 70s, and so he seemed somewhat elusive. LeMond just told this whole generation of cyclists that it was okay to pursue this sport,
and it
could be cool.
Did he catch? I mean, it's funny because I remember when it seemed like he was really supportive of Lance until Lance won his third title. Then all of a sudden, it was like, oh my God! He the way we read it was he tied. Lance tied his record, and all of a sudden he was going to be, you know, he wasn't going to be the Greg LeMond, right? The American first, the only American went to Tour de France, then the guy with three titles. Lance was going to go by him. So it's easy to look at Greg as being bitter and just jealous. It took me a long time to realize that the guy, you know, had legitimate concerns. What was the read for you guys with LeMond early on when he started talking trash about Lance?
It was exactly as he said. It just seemed like he was no longer going to be the three-time guy, the winningest American at the Tour, and so he just seemed like kind of a bitter. His comments seemed bitter and cranky.
Yeah.
But if you've spent any time with Greg, you know he's anything but bitter. He's a really warm, engaging, funny guy.
Right.
And extremely generous with his time, and also, you know, like they say around here, not for nothing, he knows from dope, right? I mean,
right.
He was in the middle of it. He was a kid over there, you know, racing his squat races and things like that, and so he knew what was going on. And so to have him say, I think this is this smells funny. You have to listen to him.
Right.
I have a story about that.
Yeah.
In like 1999 or 2000, I forget exactly what year it was, but I went to an event in New York City for the Greg LeMond. It was like a Greg LeMond. It was for a foundation that helped disabled athletes.
Uh-huh.
You know, some of them were wounded soldiers, some
right.
of them were wounded policemen, stuff like that. And they took them on. They used bike rides. And they would go all over the world to ride, and Lance came to this event. Like Greg was the featured speaker; he was being honored.
Mm-hmm.
And Lance, at the time, was still married to Kristen.
Right.
And I don't know how it ended up happening, but I got in the elevator after the event with the two of them, and they didn't talk to each other. It was even then. It was very clear that something
was going
not,
on.
Something was not right between the two of them. They just didn't seem all that happy.
You know, when I look at it, when Major League Baseball had their steroid scandal with McGuire and Sosa, but the numbers, people came out. People,
right.
it was really sort of the golden era of everybody was watching the home run race, and it brought the sport back from the strike from years earlier.
Right.
When the era you talk about from 90, really from Lance through through his whole era that you were involved with, to a certain degree, that the numbers of people watching Outdoor Life Network then versus and totally getting into the sport, Trek and everybody else benefited. Oakley, is it hard not to look at that? Is this an era that was great for cycling?
Yeah, we all benefited from it.
I mean, Lance,
one of Lance's lines is about how Trek, when he got involved with Trek, it was like this regional company in Wisconsin, and now it's a $1 billion multinational.
Right.
And that's true. Bicycling Magazine reached, I can't say for sure that it was peak, but it was much higher circulation during the Lance era, and the magazine was nice and thick with ads just because of all the people who came to it. And
right.
I have to think that you were probably in the same position
as
I was, looking at it, but also thinking, like, you know, whoever would have thought a cyclist would be on the cover of Sports Illustrated?
Yeah.
Whoever thought that a cyclist would be Sportsman of the Year? I mean, you remember when you were a kid and, like, people looked at you and thought you were funny? I had a girlfriend whose father threatened to beat me up because I showed up on a bike one time at her house. I mean, whoever would have thought that this
yep.
sort of stuff would happen, and it was all good for us. And then, you know, the thing that I'm still trying to reconcile is that it was all fabricated on
smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
But the hard part for me, and I've had Mark Ziegler from the Union Tribune here, who's sort of our drug expert, and we talk about the HGH testing in the NFL, and you know, in cycling, it goes back a couple weeks. In the NFL, it's like 10 hours. So right. Cycling has taken the brunt of and track and field of the media because they test. The other sports really don't. It's so random about what they do. So you know, it's hard. I don't think there's any question if they tested after the Super Bowl and didn't give it out the trophy until you know until everybody tested didn't test positive. I don't think we'd be giving out trophies.
I don't think that you can have a sport or have any sort of human endeavor where so much money is at stake and not expect people to bend, if not completely ignore the rules.
Right.
I mean, it's true on Wall Street. It's true in politics. And it's true in sport. And, you know, to your point about football, if you've ever watched an NFL game or even a Division I college game, from the sidelines or from very low down in the stands, it is breathtaking.
Yeah.
How big these guys are, how fast they move, and how quickly they get to speed within one or two steps. And you can't tell me, I mean, Sam Apt once said, like, you know, about Floyd's epic ride that day.
Yes.
You know, you don't think he did that on Steak Frites, did you? you know, I look at those guys, and you know, it's just not possible that they could be that big without some sort of boost.
Well, so, and if I compare it to cycling, think back to we used to have strong guys who you know were great in the time trials and sprinters, and then you had the little Colombian guys, right, who scampered up the mountainside.
Right.
All of a sudden, when drugs came in, a George Hincapie could power up the big hills, and you didn't need the little Colombian guys anymore. They sort of disappeared. In football, same type of thing. People used to be big, or they were fast. Now they're big and fast. And
Hincapie won a stage with a finish at the top of a Pyrenean mountain.
Yes.
And this is like, this is big George.
Right. I know. Right? I know.
So, I mean, there's that, and, you know, poor Hushfeld winning breakaways. Winning stages with long breakaways, you know, almost a solo breakaway. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's things have fundamentally changed. But you know, I don't know how much you want to lapse into baseball, but
yes,
you know, can you also remember when shortstops were literally the shortest, smallest guy on the field?
They were 5'7". They were Scooter. They
right.
were you know,
exactly.
Scooter
exactly.
And Pee Wee. Scooter and Pee Wee were playing shortstop.
Yeah, and now you know, with it was like Nomar Garciaparra, Jeter.
A-Rod.
And A-Rod, who sort of turned all that on their head, and it's completely different.
Totally
and same,
different.
Same is true with ice hockey. I mean, ice hockey players are huge now.
6'5", 6'6", 6'7".
Right.
So, your favorite cycling moment?
Wow. This is going to show my age, but Andy Hampston...
Giro. Yeah, in the snow.
In the snow. It's just still such a singular image in
yes.
my head.
Yeah.
And I think it is for an awful lot of cyclists. You know, followed closely by LeMond erasing the deficit in the time trial into Paris.
89.
Laurent Fignon. But
yes.
You know, there are other great moments that I remember from Lance's time and Floyd's time, but I just can't put them in the list of
exactly.
favorites anymore.
I know. Hey, Steve, congratulations on the book. Embrace the Suck is the name of the book, and it's available everywhere, Steve?
It is. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it in better bookstores, as they say. And if you're in central New Jersey, you can buy it from the trunk of my car. Come on by.
And Steve is a family guy, so please buy a book and buy about 10 of them for your friends
exactly.
for holiday gifts because
exactly.
it's important to embrace the suck so that Steve's kids can embrace college.
Exactly.
Thank
you, Bob.
You're welcome, Steve. Hey, Steve, thank you so much. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
All right. So Steve Madden has been our guest again. The book is Embrace the Suck. If you have not tried CrossFit, you really need to get out there. And I think the book will give you a great entree into what CrossFit is all about from a guy who was an endurance athlete who moved into the world of the box. This, again, has been Babbittville Radio. We're brought to you by the California 1020. Coming up on Sunday, February 15th, Del Mar Fairgrounds, San Ysidro, and back 10 miles, 20 bands, great post-race concert, cal1020.com, try-palooza.com, Saturday, February 21st. Core Sports, very best in women's athletic wear and function smart physical therapy. Go see our buddy Gino Cinco. Hold on, everybody. We'll be right back.